When you're about to make a major life decision, you want a little input, right? You check with family and friends and ask if you're doing the right thing. In organizations with multiple people involved, decisions are often formed by teams. And when they need a challenge to their decision-making process, they will often call in a red team. This is the team expected to provide a serious test to the findings and thinking of the primary team, in essence, to fire bullets at the plan on the table. Our next guest wrote a book about this process. Micah Zanko is the author of Red Team, How to Succeed by Thinking Like the Enemy. Micah Zanko attended the U.S. Army's Red Team University, one of the first civilians to do so. He has written about national security issues for major newspapers and writes the blog Politics, Power, and Preventive Action. Micah is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Micah Zanko, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
I should say first, the Council on Foreign Relations in our listening area seems to still raise some hackles with some people. What does go on there?
That's a great question. Council on Foreign Relations is a relatively polite centrist think tank where it has a bunch of different components from meetings to members, but I work in what's called the Studies Department, and the Studies Department is essentially the think tank within the think tank. If people are interested in how we get funded, we have an annual report which lists all of our funding sources. We don't take U.S. government money. We don't take foreign government money. We take almost no corporate money. We're mostly funded by nonprofits and gifts from CFR members. I have this great honor and privilege of literally thinking and writing and talking to smart people for a living. And it's only because of the opportunities that CFR provides that I got to write this book.
I can relate to the job, talking to smart people for a living.
Yeah.
The think tank within the think tank, are you something of a red teamer yourself then?
I would never sort of claim that I am or I could be. You know, the theme of the book is you can't grade your own homework, because we all have these institutional biases and these sort of issues of groupthink and hierarchy that makes it difficult for us to evaluate ourselves. So I would never ask somebody working in an organization to describe their role in a way that you should believe or is going to be honest or forthright, because we are going to be the least likely to identify it. Just like if I asked you describe your role within the public radio sphere, I would find your opinion of yourself and your evaluation skeptical. And so the whole point of that is recognizing that there's probably things you don't know about yourself and your business, and you should probably have some humility. And that's part of what got me to this topic, just realizing that there are limits to what we know. When you work somewhere every day with people very closely, you start to think alike, act alike. You're less likely to identify blind spots. You're less likely to challenge assumptions and tell your boss or somebody who can do something with that information. So I wouldn't say I am, because I'm now, having written the book, realized that the inherent difficulty of doing that.
So red teamers, it sounds like by nature, have to be at least slightly outside the corporate culture or the organizational culture anyway.
They generally are, but one of the things I've sort of learned looking at the military and the intelligence world in the private sector at red teams and all these different spheres is there are rare individuals who do act and think differently. They're mavericks, but everywhere mavericks exist, they're hunted down and killed. And the reason they're hunted down and killed is because they put at risk everybody's performance ratings. They put at risk the mission. They raise issues that people would rather be willfully ignorant about. So mavericks are a pain in the butt. Everybody knows one or two people who is a maverick, but the fact that they are so rare and the fact that they are often retaliated against or silenced sort of demonstrates the limited impact they can have to change culture within organizations.
Now, you take this back to the Catholic Church. How far back and for what purpose did the Church use something resembling a modern-day red team?
So I was just fascinated by the concept. When you talk about red teaming, most people talk about devil's advocates, right? And this is somebody who's usually assigned to come to a contrary or opposing position. And strangely enough, there's really no history of the devil's advocate, in English at least, that you can find. And so I just went through all the sources I could. And it's a kind of a fascinating story, because for the first 700-800 years of the church, or even 1,000 years of the church, basically anybody could, based upon a strong profession of the faith and alleged miracles, become a saint. They were named a saint by the local religious authority from where they were from. But over time, the Vatican, which wanted to control this, the bestowing of this title and wanted to centralize control over all church activities, They basically said no more can local communities decide who is a saint. It can only go through the Vatican process. And so they set up something that was like a trial where you had to sort of lay out the best case of this person, lay out the evidence of miracles having been performed by this person. And they also created a position in the Latin term as advocus diaboli, or devil's advocate. And this was the person who was trained, educated, and tasked to come up with every piece of critical and damaging and harmful information to the saint candidate. And so these trials would last decades and decades. People would come up with more information, allegedly demonstrating the commitment of the miracle, and then the devil's advocate would come up with more damaging, harmful information. Some of these trials actually lasted over a century.
Wow.
And so we learned that in the first, in 1982, Pope John Paul did away with the job, and there was less institutional checks on the saint making. So the story of the devil's advocate is that there were more saints made in the last 30 years than in the previous 1700.
Interesting. And of course, Pope John Paul himself is on his way to sainthood at the moment, John Paul II. We'll talk more about devil's advocates and red teams and all those things that are implied by the concept of red team. Mike Kozenko, the author of the book by that name. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange, and take phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mike Kozenko, a security expert and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's written a book called Red Team, How to Succeed by Thinking Like the Enemy. It's about the people who operate inside organizations, challenging the assumptions of those organizations as they're about to embark on major moves. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Micah, as you were describing what went on within the Catholic Church about the devil's advocate and the trials, really, of the saints to bring up information that would seem to preclude them from being saints, it sounds like the original opposition research, but in-house opposition research, like political candidates do.
Right, and these were people who were trained specifically to do that. They were protected, so nobody could retaliate against them from coming up with bad information. And you can find evidence of travelers who went and witnessed some of these trials. And as devil's advocate was created, that term existed for that purpose, that they were to assume the role of the devil to find out all the harmful, malicious, and damaging information that opposed the position of this person becoming a saint. And so one of the issues, just to get back, was that in 1982, Pope John Paul basically did away with this position. Subsequently, more saints in the last 30 years than the previous 1700, and a lot of close watchers of the church and people who are close professors of the faith say that the Vatican has become what they call a saint-making factory. And so people that when that institutional check is removed, it is much easier for people to become canonized, and that's something that people sort of worry about.
Is there any idea of the origin of red team? Does that come from the color of the devil or something?
So, interestingly enough, the concept comes from the late 1950s, early 60s. It's a creation of the U.S. military and like the Rand Corporation, and red comes from the Soviet Red Army.
Ah.
And it was modeling all the different ways that U.S. and NATO forces could have encountered the Soviet Union, like an exchange in the Fold the Gap in Germany through East Germany, or it was used specifically to describe what would be the Soviet position in certain arms control negotiations. And the first public example is in 1962. There's a political reporter, a columnist, who goes to the Pentagon, and he actually describes, he meets with Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, and he says there's a strange game being played at the Pentagon backwards, where Secretary McNamara calls his red team, quote, devil's advocates. And what they were doing was assessing the decision to buy a certain type of a bomber between Boeing and Grumman or whoever it was at the time. And one team was assuming the role of an opposition force who was to find every reason to oppose the decision that they decided to pursue.
You know, I can just imagine people sitting here listening to this thinking they never seem to do the red team now to decide whether or not to actually buy the hardware.
They do, but it's a much less adversarial sort of thing. So when as you listeners might know, there was a big decision recently reached about what's called the long-range bomber, which is what's going to replace the B-2 and the B-52 at some point. It won't come on, you know, come into effect for about 20, 25 years. But they announced the winner, and then as soon as they announced the winner, the competing aerospace company basically says, you know, the contract and the decision-making process was totally flawed. And then the Government Accountability Office, which is a research arm in Washington, part of the federal government, does an independent assessment of it. But that's different than being a sort of truly devious adversarial check on things. They're just trying to see that all the boxes were checked, which is slightly different from classical red teaming.
So one of the case studies you provide here is about Al-Kibar, the location of what appears to have been a nuclear reactor in Syria a few years back, and the approach to going. Where were red teams used in deciding how to move on that issue?
So in the spring of 2007, the Israeli prime minister and other Israeli defense officials come to the White House, and they meet with President George W. Bush, and they lay out evidence that there is this strange building being built in southern Syria near the Euphrates River, and from initial impressions, it looks a lot like a nuclear reactor. And in fact, it looks a lot like a moderated graphite nuclear reactor, which is the kind North Korea has at Yongbyon, where they've made plutonium that they've used for nuclear tests. And we know that there's some exchange of long-range missile technology and sharing between North Korea and Syria. So they went to George W. Bush and they said, we want you to bomb this because we're Israel and we don't want to go in and do it. It would be better if you did it. So George Bush turned to his director of central intelligence, Michael Hayden, who I interviewed, and Mike Hayden formed two red teams. One was he got an outside expert who had no information about this, gave this outside expert who did not work in government access to all the photography that the U.S. took, all these sort of environmental samples, all the evidence they had, and this person said, I have no doubt this is a reactor. There's no other explanation for it. It's near a river source. It looks like a water cooling plant. It looks like they're building a reprocessing facility to get the plutonium to make a weapon if you wanted to. So he said, great. So then Mike Hayden formed a second red team, and he found people in the CIA who had never been read in on the intelligence. So they had no idea about this. They hadn't seen it. He then said to them, you get access to all the information you want, all the photography, and you have one responsibility. You have to come to the conclusion that this is not a nuclear reactor. So he tasked them with coming to the analytical conclusion that there was not a nuclear reactor. So they looked at everything. They thought, is this some vanity project for Bashar al-Assad? Is this like a home or some monument? Is this connected to long-range missile testing? Or what is this doing here? And the ultimate conclusion they came to, they said, we believe this is a fake nuclear reactor. That was the only conclusion they could come to, that it wasn't a nuclear reactor. It was a fake nuclear reactor.
Because they were told they could not come to the conclusion it was a nuclear reactor?
Right. I mean, and some of the evidence included literally, they had, whether this was provided to the Israelis or somebody else, I don't know, but it was photography of North Koreans physically at this facility, walking around as technicians and helping to get it up and running. So this is all reported to George W. Bush, and he's actually made much more comfortable, because after the Iraq WMD debacle, he wants the best information about weapons of mass destruction estimates. Now, ultimately, George Bush decided not to bomb Syria, and the reason he did is he was up to his eyeballs with a raging insurgency in Iraq, was still heavily invested in Afghanistan, and as Secretary of Defense Robert Gates famously said around this time, you know, each president only gets to start a new war in a Muslim country. And he thought, it's a bad idea, while we're so heavily invested in Iraq and Afghanistan, to go to war with Syria. So Israel goes in and bombs the reactor and destroys it anyway. But the point is that the extra critical analytical take that these two red teams did made the White House and George Bush in particular more comfortable with the decision that he made. They provided additional information for him. It wasn't determinative in his decision, because he had other things, you know, as part of his calculus to not bomb it, but it just makes people more comfortable with the intelligence product.
Mike Ozenko is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of the book Red Team, How to Succeed by Thinking Like the Enemy. The red team are the people you bring in to fire bullets at your assumptions and your plan and find the holes, find the flaws. Join us on the Exchange with this discussion at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's stay in the Middle East and George W. Bush. It sounds like that the double red team thing might have arisen from the fact that it sounds like they... Well, did they have a red team, poking holes in the plan for the Iraq invasion in the first place?
So for the intelligence of whether or not Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, no. And you can famously read, you can Google it and find the CIA's Office of Inspector General did a summary report of why they came to the conclusion, despite clear specific evidence, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And a lot of it just had to do with mirror imaging. It was analysts trying to think like they imagined Saddam Hussein thought. They could not imagine that he had to maintain the fiction of weapons of mass destruction, both to shore up domestic political support and to try to deter his nearby countries from attacking him or raising political or military disputes. So he had to maintain the fiction of it, and they couldn't imagine that. Right? They thought if he looked like he had it, he must have it, but actually he didn't have it. So. That wasn't done, but the more critical example, which relates to how the U.S. Army red teams today, was the people who planned the ground campaign in Iraq in 2003, they met with a lot of Shia exiles. They met with various Iraq experts, many of whom told them this is going to go really poorly. There will be an uprising of Sunnis related to the Hussein regime. There will be people opposed to a foreign occupation force. You better be prepared to be here for much longer than you can be. And but as these people sort of described it to me, they said, you know, rather than listen to bad news and rather than prepare for the worst-case scenario, we listened to our chain of command, and we were on mission lock. You know, that's a term they use, a lot of people use. We were on mission lock. We were going to take down Saddam Hussein and assure the country had no weapons of mass destruction. So lo and behold, Hussein falls, Sunni insurgency emerges. And a few years later, some of those same people involved in planning the ground component of the war, of the campaign, they then went to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and they formed what's now called to this day Red Team University, which is a school on the top of a hill at Fort Leavenworth in a converted former military prison where they teach people from the Army, from Special Operations Command, the Marine Corps, even Customs and Border Protection, how to think like a red teamer and use red teaming techniques. And I've been out there 5 times to learn from them, and I actually took one of the courses that they give, and it really sort of changes the way you think about problems and solutions.
Hmm. Okay, so there really was an aftermath of what happened in Iraq, and that the whole process changed after that.
It did, yeah.
Another call here from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mike Ozenko, the author of Red Team.
Good morning. I've got to tell you, this is a much more important topic than it might sound like. Sounds a little esoteric, but it's the essence of having the personal freedom in an organization to practice critical thinking, and then to be able to implement that kind of critical thinking. You know, the first time I remember reading about this kind of thing was back in 1972. There was a book that we read in college called Groupthink.
Hmm. Irving Janis, yes.
Yes, yes, exactly. And to me, one of the greatest failings of our society has been the shutting down of this kind of critical thinking within organizations, either as a group, as your devil's advocate with the church, or just generally in cultures, whether you're talking about bureaucracies, whether you're talking about business structures. Critical thinking is generally not encouraged because it generally threatens the people who are already in power. And it's the thing that will probably, in the end, destroy us, in my opinion. I'll take your answers to my comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate that.
I just want to echo that's an excellent point and a great perspective of it. And one way I just tell people to think about this in their own jobs or in their own lives is nobody goes to work every morning and decides that morning what to do, right? You have a series of expected behaviors, a series of standard operating procedures. There's a climate that your boss or bosses have signaled down to everybody of how you're expected to behave, to dress, to act, to interact with each other. Over time, those externally imposed constraints upon your behavior and your values and your mood changes the way you think. It limits and constrains it. Similarly, people even from the most diverse backgrounds and histories and experiences, when they work together over time, they tend to think similarly. So it's not just, so that's one issue is groupthink, which is something that nobody can escape, even if you're very conscious of it. But the second part is in organizations that are hierarchical, we have lots of evidence that people don't, what they call in the business world, voice up, which is to give critical or challenging or dissenting viewpoints to your boss. And the reason they don't do it is, well, some people think they can be retaliated against for it, but most people think it's pointless. They realize that the way things are at their job is stuck. Nobody's willing to change, so they don't speak up. So they just sit quietly and stew. Now, what's fascinating is if you talk to senior business leaders, if you talk to general officers in the military, seniors in the intelligence community, they all make three claims. And one great way your readers might recognize it if they're curious is go read the New York Times in the business section. They have something called the Corner Office Series. The Corner Office Series is the short question and answers with senior leaders in a whole range of fields. And they all say three things. They all say, my office door is always open. I want people to come in and challenge me and to raise issues that I can't think about. That's the one claim they make. The second they make is, we work in a largely horizontal organization. I want to empower my employees to think differently and to make decisions. And then the third thing they say is, if there's a problem in my institution, I'll know about it. Either I will identify it or somebody will tell me about it. These are three flaws, and if you just think in your own organization, you probably don't experience and enjoy that sort of situation. And the belief that by bosses that they will be able to know or identify glaring problems in their strategies or their plans, or they will be able to conceive of how their adversaries will react, is a huge, huge shortcoming, and it leads to lots and lots of business failures for sure.
Mike Ozenko is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Red Team, How to Succeed by Thinking Like the Enemy. So do red teams have to be composed of people outside an organization, ideally?
Well, they can be, but that's often an expensive way to do it. Now, the problem with just taking, again, when you work with people 5 days a week, 10 hours a day or more, you become alike, you start to think alike. If you decide one day, well, we're going to go on a retreat, or we're going to go in this conference room, or we're going to leave our phones out the door, and we're going to think hard, or we're going to think critically, that's just impossible, right? You can't escape what you've all experienced collectively beforehand when you walk into that door, when you go to that retreat. In the Army, they describe this as the word is bogsat, which means bunch of guys sitting around a table. And a bunch of guys sitting around a table who normally work together, the notion that they're going to suddenly be divergent critical thinkers is almost impossible. It's like riding a stationary bike. You just won't get to that place. So one of the ways you can overcome this, though, is through the use of what's called liberating structures. And liberating structures are forms of structured brainstorming that overcome these issues of the cognitive biases we experience, issues of groupthink, issues of hierarchy. And you can find these all over the internet. There, you just Google liberating structures, and you can see them. But one of my favorite examples, which you can use in your own institution, you don't have to hire outside people, is what's called weighted anonymous feedback. So this is, if there's a big strategic decision or a big strategic issue that you're debating internally, one of the things that we've learned through lots of social science surveys is it's often the case that the most junior people in the room have the best ideas, but they're going to be the least likely to voice them up. They're going to be the least likely to speak up. So if a boss speaks first, everyone's opinion leads to the boss. Or in private sector, there's a phrase I love. It's called HIPPO, H-I-P-P-O. It means highest paid person in the organization. If the HIPPO speaks first, everyone leans that way. So one way you overcome this issue is you do weighted anonymous feedback. You ask people, after discussing this issue for 20, 30 minutes, to write down their three or four best ways to overcome this issue or their best ideas about this issue. People, these cards are handed in anonymously, so only the person running the discussion, the facilitator, knows it. And then everyone goes ahead and grades, gives a score of 1 to 4, all the ideas. And what we learn in lots and lots of different settings is the most junior person, based upon the collective opinion of the group, will have the best ideas. But it's only because you run this red team structured brainstorming session that you will find that out. On your own, you will never know that.
You've opened the door in this case and said, we want this information. So you're paving the way. Mike Ezenka is the author of Red Team, How to Succeed by Thinking Like the Enemy. We'll come back on the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with him. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mike Ezenka, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a security expert. He's written a book called Red Team, How to Succeed by Thinking Like the Enemy. The Red Team is the group of people who are there to challenge your assumptions, to challenge the groupthink, and to poke holes in the arguments in favor of a certain set of decisions. And it's interesting to watch how red teams are used in the military and in lots of many other organizations now. Mike has actually attended Red Team University, put together by the U.S. Army after the Iraq invasion. You can join us at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So you just talked about liberating structures and ways in which organizations can invite input from people who might otherwise be silent, and good input at that. And pardon me if I end up sounding like Gary Cole in Office Space here, but what do you do about the manager who just doesn't want to loosen up on the lines of authority there?
Well, it's often the case that a senior leader doesn't want to know bad news. They actively discourage it from being reported, because if you are sued in the discovery process, If you empowered somebody to find bad information and you didn't act upon it, you're actually, the penalties are so much greater than if you're just willfully ignorant. It's better than being negligible. So a lot of people don't want to know about it. So one of the ways that these sort of work is you have to make the boss buy in to the need for this. So red teaming often happens as a result of some catastrophe in your industry or to yourself. And one of the sort of more prominent known examples of red teaming, which we haven't talked about today, are people who do penetration tests, who try to break into buildings or computer networks. So when there's a big, well-known hack, like 2 years ago, this very time of year, Target Corporation learned that over 70 million customers had their private information stolen, and 50 million customers had their payment card information stolen. It was a really interesting hack. Basically, these hackers couldn't get into the Target network, so they broke into Target's computer network by going through their external heating, ventilation, and air conditioning subcontractor, who had administrator access to every Target building to monitor energy levels. So first they broke into the subcontractor, and then they broke into Target. And it cost the company hundreds of millions of dollars, the CEO the job, the chief information officer the job, chief information security officer job. So after that, a lot of companies have now hired these outside penetration testers to try to break into their computer network. So you have to make it clear to the boss that there is a cost, both financially, personally, for their job, to the corporation's reputation, if they don't do it. Because on their own, again, most people in lots of different fields don't want to know that things could be bad.
Interesting. So for the efforts of any red team, you still run, in a lot of cases, the chance of the ultimate decision maker going ahead with the original plan.
Well, as I always say, a red team is never determinative. As we talked about earlier with the case of George W. Bush not bombing a suspected nuclear reactor in Syria in 2007. But what the red team is intended to do is to provide an additional check of the assumptions of the plan, to identify blind spots, to think through every conceivable way it could fail, to think through adversarial responses to your plan. Now, you might do all of that as faithfully and professionally as possible, and then the boss might still decide to ignore it. That's fine. You can never make any senior leader do anything with an analytical product, but you should always, if you're a senior leader, want to make the best decision possible. And red teams can be a very effective management tool to lead to better decision making in organizations.
We have a drop-off question from Jeannie in Medford, which might be a little tangential to this, because the organizations she's asking about are those that offer 12-step programs, which tend to be nominally leaderless organizations. She wants to know if you get into a problem with groupthink and bumper sticker thinking in 12-step groups.
That's a good question. It's not anything I've studied, but groupthink is a phenomenon that is measured and found everywhere. There is no place that you will not experience groupthink if you work closely with people. Similarly, I always invite people, and your listeners can do this, is just Google the phrase list of cognitive biases. There's a Wikipedia site. There's like, it lists about 70 or 80 cognitive biases, things like mirror imaging, anchoring effect, confirmation bias. These are all things that we experience every day. We can pretend that we are unique humans, not constrained by our previous experiences, our social surroundings, and we're really clear, creative people who do divergent critical thinking. That's a lie. what you can do is be a little bit better at it. And red teaming is one way to recognize that phenomenon exists within our own brains and within our organizations. You can try to mitigate against the effects of cognitive biases and institutional pathologies, but you can never eliminate them. And red teams are a recognition that you can't overcome these, that you should have some humility and attempt to use these techniques that I mentioned to overcome this problem.
Emily pulled up the list of cognitive biases. It's quite a list. Gambler's fallacy, the hot hand fallacy, IKEA effect, all kinds of things there. So definitely worth a look at. We have a call here from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Micah Zenko, the author of Red Team.
Thank you. I had a professor at Salk who was apparently used to work for what's called the RAND Corporation. And I was going to ask. I'm going to ask you, does that tie into anything you're doing? Or I understand you used to tell us that that's a think tank out of Santa Monica.
Uh-huh.
So this really great professor at Salk, Vaughn Barnett. But tell us a little bit about that, if you know anything about the RAND Corporation, or if it even touches this subject.
Oh, Vaughn was our guest recently. Thanks for that, John. Salk being what used to be called Southern Oregon State College is now Southern Oregon University, where we're based, Micah. But
the RAND, ironically enough, the RAND Corporation, which is in the parlance of Washington speak, I think is called an FFRDC, a federally funded research and development corporation.
In fact, RAND stands for R&D, doesn't it?
I think you're right. Back in the day, and it was basically a creation of the Air Force after World War II to think on really hard problems, specifically with regard to low Earth orbit satellites and nuclear weapons, but. It was actually the RAND Corporation where a lot of these concepts of red teaming emerge by people who are applying the emerging field of game theory to decision making. And game theory is this belief that you can sort of model and interpret adversarial positions and reactions to your positions and then reactions upon reactions. And some of those initial people at the RAND Corporation then went in after 1960 and went and worked at the Pentagon under Secretary McNamara, where the phrase sort of is formalized. So, but no, RAND is a huge. They have offices in Santa Monica, D.C., Pittsburgh, hugely respected a research organization.
You get into the best practices in red teaming, and I love the quote about how the Titanic was built with best practices. So, but outside versus inside, I mean, if you're going to bring in people from outside, are there things that either way, I mean, are there things that red teamers should not know about the organization or the plan?
So, I mean, it's really the second chapter of the book is the jewel of the book, because in the course of 5 years, I did over 200 interviews. I talked to 4 CIA directors. I talked to about 50 hackers. I talked to, I went to Leavenworth 5 times. I just talked to everyone in this field I could. And I started to find some common principles and practices about what worked and what didn't. And, I mean, the one we mentioned before, the most important best practice is the boss must buy in. If the boss doesn't care, signal their support to everyone that matters, authorize the red team, fund it. It will never get access. It will never do anything meaningful, and no one will listen to what they say. So that's one key best practice. But the other is how it's situated, because if the red team is composed simply of people who work in an organization, they're probably captured by the culture and the pathologies that enfeeble all of us. So it's unlikely that you're going to say, you should be a devil's advocate. You, on your own, I want you to think critically today. It just doesn't work. That doesn't happen. So ideally, you want people who get access to the organization, come from the outside, but know a lot about the organization, know a lot about its industry or its field or its domain, is willing to meet with leaders early and often to help them think through what they need red team, which is often a huge issue. Most bosses don't even know why they would need to be red teamed, and if you ask them what's the most critical thing to them, they can't tell you at a corporation if it's profit, market share, reputation, their own personal job, etc. So they help them think that through. But if you're too distant and you don't know the industry or you don't know the corporation, you will not provide helpful advice, and you'll be discarded fairly quickly. So you have to maintain the balance of being outside and aware of what they do, but not being too inside and too institutionally captured.
So let's talk about some specific examples. We mentioned at the very top of the hour, before we even got you on the phone, about the fact that the Bin Laden raid is mentioned in here as an example. It was red teamed. There were things that went wrong in the operation, like the helicopter that went down, but they still managed to achieve the objective of the mission. How heavily was that red teamed, to use your verb?
So one of the most important lessons to people, especially in the special operations community, was April 1980, what's called Operation Eagle Claw. This was the effort by U.S. Special Operations Forces to rescue the 50-some U.S. hostages that were being held in Iran. And if you know anything about what happened there, it was very poorly planned, conceived. They really didn't do many test runs of what happened. They had people from different services flying different aircraft, and in the middle of the Iranian desert, an aircraft that was loaded with fuel to refuel the helicopters collides with a helicopter, blows up, kills, I think, 17 U.S. soldiers, and the mission is aborted. It's a huge embarrassment. As a result of that, the special operations world in particular does tons and tons and tons of simulations and exercises and what they call pre-mortem analysis, which is thinking every conceivable way that this operation could fail, doing contingency plannings in case these sorts of things happen. So in April 2011, when President Obama authorizes the Navy SEALs, the 70 or so people, to go in and take down this compound, at one point there's a downdraft on the rotor of a helicopter, and it crashes, and it damages the tail to the extent that it can't be flown. And it's fascinating to talk to the people, not the SEALs themselves, but I've talked to people who are in the White House, and they say, like, nobody flinched. Because they had planned for losing one of the helicopters. Not only had they planned for losing one of the helicopters, but they had, in a dry creek bed, just about 20 or 30 kilometers away, they had additional helicopters that could have been brought into the area to provide firepower or extraction transportation capability. So, you know, when this potentially disastrous thing happened, nobody flinched. They just kept going on and on. And the reason was they had built a mock-up of that compound in a southwest state in the United States, and they trained against it over and over and over again. So when the real situation came, they were very ready.
We have a call here from Michael in Mendocino. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mike Ozenko, the author of Red Team.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Ozenko, could I get your opinion on how you would apply your skills to the current crisis in Syria now that the Russians are involved? And I can take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
That's a great question. And I can tell you that, red teaming is really, really great for policy challenges that are complex and seemingly stuck. So the war in Syria, the anti-ISIS campaign, is one of these challenges. And I have been asked to, for an unnamed U.S. government group, to come in and help them think about how could we apply red teaming to Syria specifically. Because some of these people at the State Department and the Pentagon and the intelligence community, they've been working on Syria for 5 years straight. They seemingly haven't moved much other than dropping a few more bombs, and now the civil war getting worse and worse and arming various opposition forces. And so it was interesting. It was fascinating because I met with them. I described red teaming. I said, this is how you could apply it. And I said, but you better be ready, because the results you find, if you do just a basic assumptions check on the U.S. strategy, and you find there are things wrong with the assumptions, you see things wrong with the plan and the strategy, you're going to have to tell your bosses, and they might not be happy to hear it, and then they're going to be unlikely to do anything about it. And so at the end of this meeting that I had with them, they decided not to red team Syria. And the reason was that what the White House wants to do in Syria is very clear to everybody. It was the speech President Obama gave on September 10th, 2014, and he actually reasserted it again just a week ago. And there's really no political room for maneuver. So when the political bandwidth is narrow and the White House, who is the ultimate bosses, have decided that this is the way things are going to be, you can't do a real comprehensive adversarial challenge to that plan or that strategy, because it's sort of set in stone. And a lot of the participants at this session were sort of frustrated. But it would lend itself to a lot of red teaming practices and techniques if there was if the leadership in either the White House or the Pentagon wanted to do it. But my sense is they're not really interested in that.
Well, which raises the final question, which is, particularly with government operations, you have political leaders potentially standing in the way, insisting that base or polls demand a different approach.
Right. I mean, political leaders are not rational calculator strategists, right? I mean, political leaders care about a range of different things, including the response of U.S. allies, domestic political support, the mood of the U.S. military and its operational tempo. So even if there was a red team assessment done of U.S. strategy, President Obama still might read it and say, thanks, but no thanks. I can't act based upon this information, given the other things I have to be concerned about.
Right. All kinds of other stuff comes into the picture. Well, it's a fascinating look at how organizations can get around their own stuckness in making decisions. Red Team, How to Succeed by Thinking Like the Enemy. Micah Zenko wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Thank you so much, Micah.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Take care.